Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, January 12th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Avi, over the past few days, thousands marched in our region demanding accountability after an ICE agent shot and killed Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis. Good was a U.S. citizen, she was a mother, and her death has become a national flashpoint, with many questioning how Immigration Customs and Enforcement operates today. By the way, since Good's shooting, ICE agents have shot two people in Portland, Oregon. All of this comes amid a historic expansion of ICE. Billions of dollars are pouring into that agency to hire more agents, purchase more weapons, but there are fewer guardrails and oversight. So today, we're going to peel back the layers. We have a really smart reporter who's on the show, who's been covering ICE and immigration issues in the U.S. for years. We're going to look at the origin of ICE, their jurisdiction, how they have changed under the Trump administration, and also what it looks like when ICE expands in local communities. And so we want to hear from you. What do you think local leaders should do if ICE ramps up in our area? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the chat. And we've seen ICE sort of go into Minneapolis, but they've also been in Chicago. They've also been in Los Angeles and other cities as well.
The number one more time is 888-477-9499. The question, what do you think local leaders should do if ICE ramps up in our area? And the first story in our trio of local news stories is kind of an answer to that question, in a sense. The killing of Renee Good by an ICE agent in Minneapolis prompted a press conference here in Philadelphia on Friday, with public officials condemning the shooting. One of those officials was Philadelphia Sheriff Rochelle Bilal, who blasted ICE overall and vowed agents would be arrested if they commit crimes here in the city. Here's a snippet of her comments.
If any of them want to come in this city and commit a crime, you will not be able to hide. Nobody will whisk you off. You don't want this smoke, because we will bring it to you.
Now, those comments went viral all over the internet, millions of views, and even prompted a response from acting ICE director Todd Lyons on Fox. Here's what Lyons had to say.
We are out there trying to do a lawful law enforcement mission, and this rhetoric right here is pure example of what we're facing every day. And, you know, I'm not one for, like, big, you know, banter or bluster, but my message to the sheriff is try it.
Okay, well, that back and forth caused some confusion, Cherry, because the Philadelphia Sheriff's Office would not be responsible for arresting anyone committing a crime here in Philadelphia. The sheriff has a very limited role. It's an elected office in Philadelphia. It mostly revolves around the transport of prisoners and executing warrants. The Philadelphia Police Department, after those comments from the sheriff went viral, was apparently inundated with calls, so much so they put out their own statement clarifying that they are not associated with the sheriff's office. A quick disclosure, the Philadelphia Sheriff's Office has paid for underwriting on WHYY within the past year. So now we're up to speed, Jerry.
Yeah, a reaction to Sheriff Bilal's comments have gotten mixed reviews. It felt like political theater to me, just because I got texts from folks all over the country. It's caused a lot of confusion. A lot of people don't really know what the Sheriff's Office does in Philadelphia.
Understandably.
They secure court buildings as well, in addition to the things you mentioned. And by the way, the mayor of the city of Philadelphia was on our show recently. We specifically asked her, you know, why hasn't she been more vocal when it comes to ICE and some of the Trump, you know, administration tactics? And she specifically said she didn't want to pick a fight. Her focus was on Philadelphia. And so the PPD has sort of followed suit. But, you know, it seems like the sheriff's office isn't afraid to pick that fight. You know, and I will say, you know, it felt like the two law enforcement agencies had somewhat of a dispute, even though it wasn't a real dispute. But I feel like this just sort of fed into the confusion over whose jurisdiction is what. And we don't really need that, especially right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for the sheriff to control whether or not people from outside the region who don't know what the sheriff does are going to receive these comments. You never know what's going to go viral. What it brought up for me is the fact that the sheriff locally has been under a lot of fire for corruption and mismanagement. There's a long list of allegations against Rochelle Bilal in her office specifically. And I think a lot of folks here who are frustrated with the sheriff's office were then frustrated that her comments were received so well by people outside the city. And to that, I mean, I think I somewhat shrug my shoulders and say that's politics today.
Yeah.
You can do a lot of things on a policy level that make a lot of people upset. But if you have one viral video, it tends to trump all of that, frankly. Yeah. And that is the way politics works in 2026. Maybe it's the way politics has always worked. I don't know. But I understand people's frustration. At the same time, it doesn't surprise me at all, because people outside of these few counties here in southeastern Pennsylvania have no idea who she is and have no idea what she does.
Yeah. Or that she has zero power to really arrest people for the reasons that it's implied. Sure. She didn't say she was going to arrest ICE, but there were some implications there. Yes. Second story today. New Jersey is the latest state to ban cell phones in public schools. Governor Phil Murphy signed a bill into law that would require school districts in the Garden State to bar students from using cell phones and other smart devices during school hours. And under the law, school districts now have 90 days to also develop guidelines on restricting the devices on buses and at school-sanctioned events. This new law goes into effect in the next academic school year. So I guess this August, September. But this is not a new issue in New Jersey. 86 districts had already gotten grants to support in-school bans on cell phones. So this is basically an expansion to all districts. And, you know, at the signing of the law, you know, Murphy, who's the outgoing governor now, says that, look, you know, the districts that had enacted these bans had, you know, kids were more focused. They had less anxiety. And guess what? They were actually talking to each other at school and not just stuck on their screens.
Well, maybe they should ban it in the workplace then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, our bosses kids are might like, not why like just, that.
Kids are like, why just us, man? No, I mean, this is tons of momentum behind these bans. You're seeing it all over the country, not just in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Delaware's got something percolating as well.
PA too.
I just think we have reached a breaking point with sort of cell phones and their power to distract. It's not just in schools. I think a lot of the focus is in schools because that's a place where you can legislate. Society writ large, I think we've just reached this point where people are looking for answers. I don't know if these bans are, they're certainly not a silver bullet. Maybe they're an answer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just think we're all looking for some way to break our attachment to our phones.
Yeah. And by the way, my niece is in high school, and her school, when she came to this high school, they had a no cell phones rule. Yeah. And she actually loves it. And she was
surprised.
Very, very happy that they had this, because a lot of bullying happens online and things like that. So now they don't have to worry about people taking pictures, doing whatever. It's like
at least
while you're in school, you could just focus on school.
And then the ultimate question there is sort of, where will the legislative line be drawn? Like in Australia, they're going so far as to straight up ban some children from using social media at all. Right. Will it end up ever going that far in this country, given the power of these social media platforms?
And given the studies that are coming out, the results, the real research that's coming out.
Story number three. I love this one, Cheryl. I love it so much.
I know you love this so much. Our resident foodie.
I got a question for you. How many different national cuisines could you eat without leaving the Philadelphia region?
A lot.
Well, someone on Philadelphia Reddit named Senor Juan Jr. is trying to find out. This is an awesome project. So far, this user has identified local restaurants with food from more than 75 different countries around the world. They're trying to get past 100. People on Philly Reddit are trying to help them out. And it's amazing. There's an Afghan place in Center City, an Albanian spot in Mount Airy, Bangladeshi in North Philly, Tajikistani in Northeast Philly, Nicaraguan in South Philly. There's even a spot in West Philly that serves food from Mauritania.
That is really, really cool.
It's amazing. It's so amazing.
Philly is an international. We're a heritage city, though.
We're a heritage city.
So I'm not surprised.
And I feel like American food culture gets a bad rap, often deservedly so, processed foods, fast foods. But where else in the world could you go to the sixth largest city in a country and eat international foods from all over the world, more than 75 different countries around the world? I do think we're so blessed here to have so many different influences and so many different cuisines from all over the world. It's amazing.
And it's
amazing.
It's one of the things that I think makes America unique. We're so international. We have people from all over the world living here in a city like Philadelphia. By the way, one of the places that I've been wanting to go to is Chateau Rouge, which serves Cameroonian French cuisine. That has been on my list. And I'm like, yes. And they have so many different places you can go.
All right.
And I feel like we're going to fill out that list. We're going to hit 100 plus.
Me and you, we're going to all 100.
Too. Yeah.
By the way.
We're going to eat our way across the world.
By the way, the smallest country on the list, I think, is Cyprus. There is a Cypriot restaurant in Center City called Canela. Great spot. And Cyprus has fewer than 1 million people. And yet you can eat Cypriot food here in the city of brotherly love. How amazing is that?
Yeah.
Shifting focus now to our main segment today. We're going to be talking about ICE, the evolution of ICE, immigration and customs enforcement. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Last week, a Minneapolis woman named Renee Nicole Good was in her car when she was shot and killed by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent. Good's death comes after many months of immigration crackdowns in cities like Portland, Los Angeles, and Chicago.
Minneapolis is the largest ICE enforcement operation thus far, with 2,000 agents arriving in the city this month, and more are on the way. That's according to DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. In the last year, the agency's budget nearly tripled, and large-scale recruitment efforts are underway, and the administration appears only to be ramping up further.
So how did the youngest federal law enforcement agency become such a permanent fixture in the headlines? What does the future look like for this rapidly growing organization? And how should local leaders be managing often incendiary federal intervention?
Yes, with us today is Caitlin Dickerson, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist covering immigration, among other things, for The Atlantic. Caitlin, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and to you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our questions of the day are this. What do you think local leaders should do if ICE ramps up in our area? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the live chat.
Caitlin, how did we get here? I understand that ICE is like a post-9/11 invention, but what preceded it? And why was ICE created in the first place?
Oh, wow. Well, we can go back to the very founding of this country, depending on what you're hoping to learn. So that's an interesting question to ask me, because I'm always really interested in the history of immigration and immigration enforcement. I think you sort of can't understand the present if you don't know about the past. So I'll keep it brief and cursory. Historically, immigration enforcement was not taken as something very serious or even considered a criminal offense pre-9/11. We've got sort of periods of ups and downs with border enforcement, but immigration, you know, unlawful presence in the United States, it's a civil infraction. And just maybe one data point that will help contextualize this for readers. Even after ICE was created, deportation officers themselves did not have the legal authority under federal code to make arrests until the early 2000s. So we're talking about deportation officers going in 20 years from not even having the legal authority to make an arrest. Deportation officers were largely people who handled logistics, to now people who walk around in American streets heavily armed, using paramilitary style tactics and weapons and gear, and very aggressively so, obviously culminating in the shooting death of Renee Good last week and other similarly violent incidents. So there's just been this massive escalation in the post 9/11 era. You know, it started with the country in a panic, trying to figure out how to prevent another terrorist attack, and focus on how the terrorists who were responsible for the 9/11 attack did come into, some of them came into the United States without, legally. They had come and gone and they hadn't been caught by immigration authorities. But that led to this escalation that has swept in millions and millions of people, and really people whose circumstances have nothing to do with preventing domestic terrorism. But that's sort of the guise under which this expansion took place.
And so we see that happening in the early 2000s. So I want people to get a general understanding of the jurisdiction of ICE. I mean, this is a federal law enforcement agency at this point, but what are they allowed to do under the law?
So again, ICE agents are carrying out civil warrants, not criminal warrants. And that's why you see so many differences in their behavior that I think can be confusing to people for sometimes. You can't enter a person's home with a civil warrant without their permission. And so ICE agents historically have had to rely on ruses to get people to open the door. They very often will come, knock on someone's door, and pretend to be looking for a different person. So they'll have a different name in mind. Sometimes they'll have a photograph of a person who doesn't live in the home and get the person behind the door to say, "Oh no, that's not me." And then the agents will say, "Oh, okay, well, thanks so much for letting me know. Can you just let me know your name so that I can move on with my day here?" The person will give their name, and then ICE will use that to confirm a positive identity of the person they're actually looking for and try to force their way into the home that way by tricking people. Now they're trying to stop people and smashing in car windows. So that's sort of a legal difference that moves in the opposite direction. Of course, we know that police officers can't just smash in people's car windows without justification. But that speaks to, these arcane legal details that really all stem from the fact that immigration officers are carrying out civil warrants. There is a criminal conviction associated with crossing the border illegally, which some proportion of the undocumented population has done. It's a misdemeanor to cross the border illegally. It's a felony to do it after you've been deported. But these immigration officers carrying out those civil warrants, and that's why they're limited and resorting to these somewhat strange tactics that we as Americans aren't used to.
Let's bring in a caller. This is Trish from Newport, Delaware, who has a question about ICE's authority in relation to Congress, I believe. Hey, Trish, you're on Studio 2. What's your question for our guest?
Hi, I'm just wondering if Congress can do anything about restraining ICE because, they're breaking laws all across the board. And if they can, then how soon can we get the Republicans out of there?
Thanks, Trish. Let me redirect that question to you, Caitlin. So, Congress has appropriated quite a bit of money to ICE, substantially more than in the past. And even under prior administrations, ICE's budget expanded. So, what is Congress's role in ICE's expansion? And if indeed, like, individual ICE agents are breaking laws, is there congressional oversight? Is there oversight within DHS? What type of oversight exists? So, a couple of questions there.
Thanks so much, Trish, for your question. Congress is incredibly important in this conversation. And as a reporter, it always kind of amazes me how they manage to point the finger of blame in other directions. I think starting with President Trump's first term, Americans really started to associate immigration policy and how it's enacted and enforced with the president. But in fact, what's been happening since the first Trump administration is that you've had administrations using policies and memos that don't carry the weight of law to try to change immigration policy in a way that they want to see it, when really this is an authority that legally belongs to Congress. Congress absolutely can rein in or change the way that ICE looks. You're right. Avi just pointed out Congress gave over $170 billion to immigration enforcement earlier this year. That is an amount of money that is larger than the military budgets of every country in the world, except for the United States and China. It more than tripled ICE's budget. And as I wrote at the time, it's important because this is an agency that has a long history of fiscal mismanagement and has been called out for mismanaging its money, for overspending and underdelivering, while having a history of health and safety problems in detention centers, of overuse of force in arrest techniques. These are problems that both Republicans and Democrats in Congress have pointed out ICE struggling with for many years and yet handed this agency a massive pay increase. And important to note, there is no oversight, no additional oversight attached to that funding increase. At the same time, the Trump administration has eliminated three offices for oversight within the Department of Homeland Security. So handing these agencies more money and actively stripping away, not just not adding, but actively stripping away mechanisms for oversight. Those three offices were created by Congress. And so you do see the administration acting in ways that seem to defy what congressional requests have been made in the past. I will say there was a lawsuit over the elimination of those three offices. They have reopened with much, much smaller staffs of contractors who are inexperienced. So suffice it to say, Congress has a lot of power to influence the way that ICE works. And, you know, I think what we're seeing right now is a metastasization and really an illustration of issues that have existed for a very long time. As we all know, Congress has been debating immigration reforms since the early 2000s and has not passed any meaningful reforms. And so these issues are all coming to a head now, because the fact is the laws were set by Congress and the Trump administration is enforcing those laws. There have been policies and memos designed to water them down, to protect certain groups and make them weaker. But if you look at the law itself, it really doesn't allow any wiggle room. If you're in the United States unlawfully, doesn't matter if you have no criminal record, if you have American citizen children, you're paying taxes, you're a contributing worker, you are eligible for deportation. And if Congress, you know, if the public doesn't want that to be the case, it has to change through Congress.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to remind our listeners of what our question of the day is. What do you think local leaders should do if ICE ramps up in our area? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat. And Caitlin, I want to sort of talk about ICE before the second Trump administration and the ICE that we're seeing now, because, you know, I've covered immigration local issues for years, and ICE has kind of always been here. We've seen ICE raids in different parts of our communities, but now it just feels like it's much more in your face and that the ICE presence is much larger. Can you sort of explain how the ramp up looks and why it feels so much more, I guess, confrontational now?
Great question. You're completely right, Cherry. The look and feel and behavior of ICE has changed really dramatically. So there are a couple things to account for that. One is that you just have far more boots on the ground. So it's not just ICE who's carrying out immigration arrests. A lot of your listeners will know the administration has detailed large numbers of Border Patrol agents who are not used to working in American cities. They're used to working in the border region, sending them into communities to carry out arrests. You have people, I've seen officers outside who were wearing vests saying BORTAC. BORTAC is a tactical unit that, you know, tends to do, for example, like a drug bust in a stash house full of people and weapons. And these are the types of folks that you now have being sent out on the street to do regular street arrests of people who have no criminal record, no experience with the criminal justice system at all, who've been in the United States for years or decades, who are working, these really heavily militarized and inexperienced officers. And then you also have, of course, a hiring spree that's going on and lots of new people. So there are just a lot more boots on the ground, and that's why immigration enforcement looks different. But the other thing is the way that these government officials are going about the enforcement. So historically, the goal for ICE when carrying out arrests was to make them, as you can imagine, this is sort of common sense, as quick, as sort of seamless and unchaotic as possible. And so that was, you know, done through going to people in their homes. I described that scenario earlier where they would go to someone's house, try to arrest them there, try to do it, you know, and this is really hard for families. They would often go in early in the morning when the kids are still sleeping. And, you know, they would arrest people at 5 or 6 a.m. before they headed out to work, which is obviously, you know, I don't want to discount how disturbing that is to wake up in the morning and your mother or father is gone. But for example, that is how ICE used to go about making arrests. Now they're trying to make a show of it. And that's the other reason why it feels so different. You know, they're trying to put forward this social media campaign. The administration really wants to push self-deportations, getting people to leave on their own. And they feel that critical to that is showing people just how awful it's going to be if you do end up encountering ICE. And so they're sort of, I think they're saying two things. You know, I've heard the administration calling on the progressives and the Democrats to try to lower the temperature on rhetoric, but I think in reality they're welcoming the drama, they're welcoming the chaos, and those situations become dangerous. We've seen at least and I think more than 11 people shot at by ICE officers during this administration. I think the most recent maximum for an entire year I'd heard of was 5, and that was a high year. So that's why enforcement looks different, and I think will continue to look different because it is different.
So you got to this idea of what the goal might be. One potential goal is deterrence. Right now, border crossings at a very, very low level. So perhaps that's working, or it's worked sufficiently and there's no need to do anything more. You said another goal might be self-deportation. Is there any evidence that this uptick in very visible arrests and detentions has encouraged people to self-deport?
I think people are leaving. I mean, the administration has thrown out very high numbers. I want to say at one point they said 2 million undocumented immigrants had left the United States. I don't think we have enough evidence to know that that's the case. They were sort of basing that on census responses relative to the overall number of visas that we know we've granted. But the fact is, I think people are really discouraged from participating in the census and participating honestly right now, because anybody who was born outside the United States, and especially if they have a precarious status or no status, is quite nervous. But I am anecdotally hearing across the country about people who are leaving, and I've written about some of them, and I'm going to be writing about some of them in stories that are going to be coming out soon. I mean, the nature of living in the United States looks very different right now. You know, one of the things that have made the United States such a popular destination for immigrants, it's not just our robust economy and the availability of jobs, but it's democratic freedoms and safety, and knowing that, you know, you can send your kid to school and go outside and expect not to be attacked, and, you know, even expect to be able to protest and push back on policies that you don't like. And all of that is sort of in flux right
Let
now.
me ask you a quick follow-up, Caitlin. So I think for folks who would be, in support of what the administration is doing, they would say, look, there's 10 million plus people who are here undocumented. This has been the case for many, many years. And the Trump administration is doing the only thing that they essentially can do, which is scare folks, frighten folks into leaving. What has been sort of what's the response to that argument that this is really the only tactic available to the Trump administration if indeed they are serious about trying to get millions and millions of people to leave this country?
I think if you want millions of people to leave the country, the options are to convince them to do it on their own or to do it by force. So I don't think there is much of a response. You know, I think the polling suggests that most Americans don't like the way that immigration enforcement looks right now. There were, of course, lots of people who were concerned about the border and lots of people concerned about overall numbers leading into the 2024 election. But I think polling really clearly reflects that people maybe didn't know what immigration enforcement was actually going to look like. And now that they're seeing it, they're not happy with it. But of course, some of the electorate is. And you're right, there is no easy way to extricate a massive population out of a country, people who have children, who own homes, who have jobs, and who are embedded in their communities. It's going to be messy no matter what.
Yeah, and by the way, some of those poll numbers, they show the approval of Trump on immigration is decreasing. The Pew Research Center says 50% of Americans surveyed in October disapproved of the Trump administration's approach to immigration, while 39% approve. And so, Caitlin, my question to you is, you talked about these different types of agents that have always worked for immigration, customs, and enforcement now being deployed in U.S. cities, something they hadn't done previously. I wonder what kind of training we're seeing these agents undergoing, and then also, are they getting training specifically to deal with U.S. citizens? And I ask you this because in Minneapolis, you have protests, in L.A., you have protests, and you know, local law enforcement has different training. Their job is to protect citizens while they sort of, you know, exercise First Amendment rights. How much of that type of training goes to ICE agents?
Thank you for that great question, Cherry. A couple things. The training is decreasing under this pressure to get as many deportations carried out as possible and to bring new agents online as quickly as possible. So the training that ICE agents undergo when they're first brought onto the job has decreased very significantly. They're getting about half of the amount of information and practice and exercises that they did in the past. And I think you're just seeing a wide degree of variability of training on the ground. You know, certainly there are people who've worked for this agency who are very familiar with the law, with the constitutional protections for both citizens and non-citizens who are out on the street doing their work, although there has been huge turnover at ICE and throughout the Department of Homeland Security. I've heard from so many officials who I've known for years who've left and say that all of their colleagues have left because they really don't recognize this agency anymore. And then to your point, though, are they getting training for these new types of enforcement actions that they did not historically do? And I am not seeing any evidence that they are. So an example of that, you know, I spoke to lots of law enforcement officers about Renee Nicole Good's death and really zeroing in on the limited information we have, acknowledging that we need to see an investigation and there's a lot of information that hasn't come out yet. But looking at the videos alone, the law enforcement officers I interviewed were very troubled from the very beginning with how that scenario was handled and said that it really didn't align with their training at all. Starting from an officer whose name we still don't know, rushing up to her car, using profanity, trying to force open the door. This veteran ICE officer I interviewed, Jim Riley, who worked in Chicago for decades, said to me, I would have walked up to the door and said, ma'am, please shut off your car and get out. I mean, he sounded bewildered. And he specifically said that when you rush up to somebody like that, yelling at them and trying to force open their door, that makes people panic. It puts them into fight or flight mode, and is probably why, in his view, she tried to speed away in the first place. But then you have the officer who we understand is Jonathan Ross, who ultimately shot Renee Nicole Good and killed her. Officers, multiple law enforcement officers I interviewed pointed out that their training says you don't stand in front of a vehicle, that it puts yourself unnecessarily in harm's way. There's a specific reference to this in ICE's use of force policy that says officers should not put themselves in scenarios, physical situations where they can only use or the will they might be forced to use lethal action. And then, of course, the shooting of the weapon itself seems to go against what the policy calls for. So lots of concerns with training.
I want to read a couple comments here from YouTube. Craig Wilson, 5233, says local leaders should arrest these guys if they ramp up here. If they are doing illegal acts, arrest and charge them. Judy Bennett, 1972, says, Caitlin, how is it legal for ICE agents to be unidentified beginning with masks, no ID badge, such as police have? I think there's some confusion here about whether or not what ICE agents are doing is simply morally repugnant to some people or whether it is actually illegal. From what you've seen out there, the various videos out there, are you seeing illegal conduct by ICE? Are you seeing simply conduct that repulses people morally?
So illegal is really difficult, and we'd have to take that on a case-by-case basis and be very specific. I think what we're seeing a lot of is just behavior that people find, as you said, as you put it, to be morally repugnant or that sort of defies their basic expectations of how law enforcement
will
and
behave.
Justice works in the United States. So as far as I know, legally, ICE officers are not required to identify themselves. Although I have heard from these many officers who've been with the agency for a long time that I told you about, that they always identified themselves because that's another way that you ensure an operation goes safely. If you walk up to somebody as a law enforcement officer and you're wearing plain clothes and you don't identify yourself, but you have a weapon and you start aggressively asking questions, it's sort of a recipe for a violent altercation and just not good law enforcement.
And how about the masks as well? I mean, that is legal.
As far as I know, and as far as anybody, any expert has been able to determine at this point, that is legal, but it's new and it defies the understanding that people tend to have about what law enforcement is supposed to look like, how it interacts with the public. So again, this is a question for Congress. And I just think that's really important for people to keep in mind because all of what ICE is doing and what it the standards that it's held to and the rules that it must abide by, those are all determined by
By
Congress. And
Congress,
I
yeah.
think that the executive branch kind of sucking up a lot of oxygen there has been confusing for
Yeah.
people.
Thanks for helping to break that down, Caitlin Dickerson. We'll hear more from Caitlin on their side of this break. We're also going to bring in Matt Sepik, who worked for Minnesota Public Radio, to get a sense of conditions on the ground there. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We want you to answer this question. What do you think local leaders should do if ICE ramps up here in Philly? Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking to Caitlin Dickerson, a reporter covering immigration for The Atlantic, about the evolution of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency under Trump.
And now we'd like to bring in another guest. Matt Sepik is a courts and legal affairs reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. He has been covering the immigration crackdown in Minnesota and the fallout from Renee Nicole Good's death. Matt, welcome to Studio 2.
Glad to join you.
We'd like to hear from you listening as well. What do you think local leaders in our area should do if ICE ramps up? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, we have a caller on the line, but we're going to get to them in just a moment because, Matt, we got to ask you, you've been on the ground in Minneapolis since Renee Good's shooting. Could you sort of describe the energy, the vibes in Minnesota among the public and law enforcement as folks deal with the aftermath?
Well, there's certainly a lot of fear and anger on the part of the public. There have been many large protests in the streets, certainly last Wednesday after Renee Good's killing in South Minneapolis. There were thousands of people who came out for a vigil. There have been other protests in the subsequent days, including at the Minnesota State Capitol. And it's important to note these have been largely very peaceful gatherings. There were a few people arrested for property damage, actually around 30 people a few nights ago here in downtown Minneapolis, people protesting outside a hotel where they believed ICE agents were staying. But other than that, these demonstrations have been peaceful and people have been largely abiding by the admonitions from Governor Tim Walz and Mayor Jacob Frey to stay peaceful and not give the Trump administration, in their words, the show that they are looking for.
Yeah. And by the way, my second part of that question was law enforcement. What's been the vibe? Because, you know, typically this is a law enforcement issue, but you have another agency coming in. Have you seen any tension there between federal agents and local law enforcement?
Well, the main point of tension was the investigation into the shooting of Renee Good. Initially on Wednesday after it happened, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension said that it would be working on a joint investigation with the FBI. And that's typically what we see in these cases. We saw it last summer following the assassination of Melissa Hortman and her husband and the school and church shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church in August. Those were joint state and federal investigations. Both agencies brought all their resources to bear, as they do whenever there is a high-profile critical incident. It is a very big deal that is not happening here now. We learned on Thursday from the BCA superintendent, Drew Evans, that they were pulling out of the investigation because the FBI declined to share evidence. It is not sharing evidence with the state investigators. So some tension there. Police have, here in Minneapolis, on the streets, have been out to essentially prevent property damage and things from escalating into violence. And so far, the great blessing that I can report is that has been largely successful. As I say, around 30 people arrested the other night, but that has been the extent of it. A few thousand dollars in property damage, graffiti, broken windows, and the like.
How have people been responding at the grassroots level on the ground when ICE is carrying out various enforcement actions around the region? Is it just people sort of in an informal way whipping out cell phones and filming? Is there something more organized where people are trying to say, like, hey, give us a heads up when something is happening? You know, a sort of a predetermined group of people will go and try to document that. Like, what's been the sort of local citizen response to the specific enforcement actions that you've seen around the region?
It's been robust and it's organized. You know, it may appear random at first glance because you see a lot of people showing up to film, but they connect with each other over text, over Snapchat, over various applications. And if there is an ICE raid in a particular neighborhood, people show up and film. In fact, I spoke with a couple late last night who heard about something happening in their neighborhood in North Minneapolis. They drove, parked a good distance away. They did not want a repeat of the situation that we saw on Wednesday. They walked up and filmed and told me there were, and there's video of this that the Associated Press has published, of about 30 plus people gathered around this house as agents went to arrest a man in the house. And I apologize for kind of burying the lead on this. They went in without a judicial warrant. They broke down the door of a home in North Minneapolis searching for a what I later learned to be a 38-year-old man. I'm not sure what the grounds were for arresting him. I see that he has a few traffic violations, and I don't know where he's from, presumably someone from overseas. Maybe overstayed a visa, we don't know at this point. But these agents came masked, wearing tactical gear in multiple vehicles, and used a battering ram to open this door. There were children inside, and they said they had a warrant, but it was just one of these administrative warrants from DHS. It was not a warrant signed by a judge, as is required to enter a home.
And by the way, as we get ready to wrap up with you, Matt, I wonder what this flux of federal law enforcement, ICE agents, does to community trust in law enforcement, and just generally when you see this type of increased activity, and you have more and more people seeing ICE carry out these types of actions.
It's certainly not engendering trust with law enforcement, particularly federal law enforcement. And there seems to be on ICE's part, a way of deliberately confusing who's who. They're obviously masked. They don't show what agency they're from. And in fact, they're wearing generic vests, bulletproof vests that say police on them. They don't say what agency. There's no insignia, no name tag or anything. It's really entirely anonymous, and that on the part of the public is greatly damaged credibility with certainly those agencies, but possibly law enforcement writ large. You don't know who is who when people are masked.
That is Matt Sepik, courts and legal affairs reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Matt, we know you're incredibly busy. Thanks for taking some time with us today on Studio 2 here in Philly.
Thank you.
I want to bring in a caller now before we get back to Caitlin. Mm-hmm. We've been asking folks what you think local leaders here in Philadelphia should do if ICE ramps up enforcement in the Philadelphia region. On line 2, we have Dan from Windmore, Pennsylvania. Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I think that the local officials right now should have federal lawsuits already drafted to be filed if necessary, and they ought to be in touch with Congress people. The more they hear from local people, maybe it will sway them. Hmm. Also, the police in whatever locality should not start a war with ICE, but they all should be ordered out on the street with body cams running at all times. I think how you interpret a scene depends on the viewpoint, not only your viewpoint, but where there's cameras. I never saw this guy get hit who shot into the car. Trump is saying he was run over. Does anyone even know if he got bruised? So the angles that you can see from really are important.
Yep. I want to bring another caller now because Dan brought up this possibility of lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And I think George from Center City has a question about ICE and legal liability. So George, you're on Studio 2. What is your question for Caitlin Dickerson of The Atlantic?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call. I have a different perspective from where I stand. I was one of I served in the National Guard for almost 40 years. I did four presidential inauguration security responses. I was also called up during the January 6th civil disobedience. And I was deputized on some of the missions. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how come, or how is it that ICE agents, can they be held accountable the way police officers can be held accountable with, like, excessive force lawsuits, those kinds of things? Is there any kind of civil litigation that they can face, and even though we don't know who their identity is?
Great question from George. Caitlin Dickerson from The Atlantic, can you help George help us? What type of liability do ICE officers face? Is it different from the liabilities of local law enforcement?
Thank you for that question, George. And I want to dig into it even deeper, to be honest with you, because it's really important to understand right now. I will say I have heard of civil payouts and civil lawsuits over use of force at the hands of ICE officers, but it is different to bring a civil case against the federal government. And I know that from my reporting on family separations, that when families wanted to bring civil suits against the government, they had to use the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is this sort of arcane process to try to minimize civil suits against the government. But I have heard of civil cases regarding health and safety issues. So I do think that it's possible. I think, again, I would point to Congress. Congress can do congressional inquiries, and Congress can also make clearer what recourse may be able to, you know, what are the rules for use of force that federal immigration officers are held to, and what are the consequences for violations of those rules? But that's a good question. You know, there was a mention of police going out into the street to hold ICE accountable. And I think I heard the mayor of Minneapolis talk about how legally that would be possible. But the difference, he said, was that their guns are bigger than ours. And I don't think anybody wants a sort of violent standoff in American cities right now. But at the same time, this escalation seems to be untenable for some communities. So again, I just keep going back to Congress, and I know I sound like a broken record, but it's because, you know, civil disobedience has an important history in the United States, obviously, and there are lots of focus on ICE, and there's lots of focus on being in the streets and photographing and videoing ICE. And I think, you know, for accountability reasons, as a journalist, I can see the appeal there, because we want to know what's happening, and we know that we're not always getting the full answer. So, you know, I can definitely see the intention there. But I do think that it's interesting to me as a journalist how Congress seems to skirt the same level of attention, when in fact Congress is responsible for ICE, for its size, for its budget, for its use of force practices, for the gear and the weapons that it has available. So it's just an important reminder for people who are thinking about how to respond to this moment.
And I wanted to kind of talk about the accountability issue, because currently, and I think Matt talked about this a little bit in his remarks, we have a situation where there is an investigation going on as to that killing of Renee Good. And I just wonder, when you have a situation where the state would normally participate in the investigation and they're not, and that we also have a lack of accountability because some of the oversight functions have been stripped from ICE, your thoughts on how public perception, you know, lawmaker perception, everybody's perception of this investigation, and I guess investigations that could take place throughout ICE's execution of actions. Just your thoughts on that, as we only have a couple minutes left in the show. But I just really wonder about, you know, the investigation arm and what it looks like given the lack of oversight.
So the investigative body is within the Department of Homeland Security to hold to account anyone who is responsible for an overuse of force, even a potentially fatal one, and also to look at policies that would be intended to prevent anything like this from ever happening again. Those bodies have been stripped away really dramatically. You know, we've heard the Trump administration sort of already render its verdict about the legitimacy of this shooting, in their view, before the investigation has been completed, before any investigative findings that have been, you know, processed and shared with the public in a formal way. I mean, within hours, in fact, the administration sort of rendered its verdict. And so I think we can expect to see a real disconnect here, because we do have the video evidence of a lot of what's happening in the streets right now, and lots of people feeling like there is a disconnect from between what they're being told is happening and what they're seeing with their own eyes. And I do think that that's a reflection of those oversight bodies being shrunken down to a sort of unfamiliar size or eliminate it completely.
But we're about to wrap up, Caitlin, but real quick, a lot of folks out there want to abolish ICE altogether. If not ICE, then what? What would be a sort of potential replacement?
I don't think that's a question you can answer quickly. Sorry, Avi. I mean, ICE is all we've had since 2003. I think that that argument comes from, people who are concerned about tactics and have been concerned about tactics for a very long time. But I also think that a lot of the frustration with ICE actually stems back to the laws. I think, people are upset about who's being arrested by ICE. That's actually not determined by ICE. And that's what lots of ICE officers will tell you is, lots of ICE officers will say, if you want to change the law, but my job is to enforce the law. Whether people want to take that at face value or not is up to them. But I do think that a lot of that frustration comes from the fact that people just tend to assume that our immigration system makes sense and that it aligns with their moral beliefs about who should be allowed to stay in the country and who shouldn't. And it actually looks very different than most people realize.
Great closing thoughts from Caitlin Dickerson, who covers immigration for The Atlantic. Caitlin, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. Really great to speak with you both.
Yes, and sorry, Carolyn from Paoli. Sorry we could not get to your call today. Hopefully you'll listen in tomorrow and call again. By the way, thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.